Podcast One.
Okay, are you recording?
Hello, great to have you on board. Welcome along to episode 15 of the Howie Games. Here in Australia, it is the first day of summer. Woohoo! No better guest to celebrate it than a seven-time world surfing champion, Lane Beachley. Lane is a fascinating, warm, engaging, intelligent, determined woman. She was an adopted child who, as she talks about in this episode of the Howie Games, was an elite athlete who at times struggled with self-doubt. But Lane had a phenomenal drive to win and win and win and win some more.
Now, crew, me and the big penguin love Lane. Big time.
She was so radical on her stick pickle. Used to get chucked out of her mind. Deep, heavy, throaty barrels. Just like me.
Turn it up, penguin. You're just a jailbreak operator.
At least I'm not on a big boogie board like you, pickle.
Ease up, pingo. Anyway, if you haven't subscribed to the Howie Games, it's time.
Don't be a fool. Be cool.
Anyway, I first met Lane when she came into Channel 7 Sports World years ago with a fellow by the name of Ken Bradshaw, who we talk about in this ep. It was my job to look after them in the green room before they went on air. Now, Ken is a big, strong, tough sort of unit, a real brooding type, a big, big, big wave rider. And Lane, well, Laney was truly like a ray of sunshine, bouncing around, making everyone feel good about themselves, and that's the Lane Beachley I know. Being a surfer that's lucky to stand up on a board, I must admit I'm a bit in awe of Lane. She's a great surfer and an even greater woman. Enjoy this chat with Lane Beachley, OAM.
Oh, my Jaja, tell me why won't they open up their eyes? They could help out if they try. If they would try.
What about this? We welcome to the Howie Games, seven-time world surf champion and a lady I've adored for a long, long, long time, Lane Beachley. How are you going?
Let the games begin, Howie.
Let the games begin.
I'm sure you've heard that a lot.
Yeah, well, most people laugh at the name, to be completely frank with
really?
You.
Really?
Well, I actually came up with it because the first episode that I did recorded was with Dennis Cometti, and this is when we were getting off the ground.
Mm.
And he all of a sudden rang me and said, yeah, let's do it tomorrow morning. And so I sat out on a surfboard having a think about what on earth am I going to call this podcast? I didn't have long and I think I did a pretty poor job of it. But what can you do, Lainey? Now you.
Well, you come up with a game, I mean a name like Howie Games.
Well, that's exactly right.
That's what you do.
And I've thought of a million better ones since then. But anyway,
well,
this is about you,
rename.
Not me. Okay. And we'll start at the start in a minute, but you've just bustled in here. It's we are recording this on the 14th of October.
Mm.
Last night, Michelle Payne has just won the Don Award for the most inspirational Australian sports performance of the year.
Mm-hmm.
You're running a little bit late. Just tell me about your morning, because this will encapsulate the life of Lane Beachley as it is today.
Well, I got... Let me tell you about the last 24 hours.
Yes, do that.
So because I was up till 3:30, 4 a.m. On Thursday night watching Tyler Wright win her maiden world title.
Fantastic.
Then I had to get up at 6 to then do a stream of media to talk about how fantastic Tyler Wright is.
Mm.
And I'm the chair of Surfing Australia, so I've become like the spokesperson for everything that happens in Australian surfing. Let's ask Lane. I'm shy of an opinion, as you know.
Oh, very, very quietly sort of spoken type. You are.
I'm a wallflower. No one puts baby in the corner.
No.
And so I did hours and hours of interviews. Then I had a board meeting for the Sport Australia Hall of Fame. And then... I've just launched a bikini range with Funkita, and it was a product for purpose campaign around my Aim for the Stars Foundation. So I designed this swimwear, and then they went on and have produced these two different styles, Beach Dreams and Surf Star, and so I went over to them to...
Where can we get them?
You can get them on Funkita.com.
Funkita, how do you spell that?
F-U-N-K-I-T-A,
Funkita.com. Cool.
Yep. So you can get some swimwear off that, and that all 10% of all the sales go back to my Aim for the Stars Foundation, which provides financial and moral support for young girls and women to achieve their dreams across all walks of life. And so after lunch, I then had to go and get my hair and makeup done and then go to the awards last night. And I'm a member of the Sport Australia Hall of Fame, sitting on the board of Sport Australia Hall of Fame. I had to sit on the VIP table, so I shared dinner last night with John Howard, Ian Thorpe, John Bertrand, John Wiley.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was and 1,100 other people.
Is Johnny Howard into his surfing? Has he ever been barreled, do you think?
He's never been barreled. He may have been in the green room, but that was in Parliament.
by you, lady.
You. He does love his sport, which is why he's co-patron along with Bob Hawke of the Sport Australia Hall of Fame. So that was fantastic. And he spoke beautifully. He got up, actually, before he got up to go and speak, he said to John Bertrand, "What do I do now?" And John said, "Just talk about how much you love sport." And he got up there and it was like he'd been rehearsing this incredible speech. He was fantastic, as John always
is. He's a great PM.
He was a great PM.
As we've seen in the last 10 years, this is not a political show, Lane.
No, I know.
We've missed Johnny.
We have missed Johnny. We've missed his leadership and just his humility and modesty. Anyway, and intelligence, intellect.
And then this morning
I was supposed to, I had a breakfast meeting, well, just time to have breakfast with Michelle Payne this morning. So that was at 9:15. I woke up at 9 a.m. And so I was almost ready to walk out the door at 9:15. And then the Premier of New South Wales, Mike Baird, gave me a call because we're talking about expanding the high performance centre up at Casuarina.
He rang you.
He rang me, yes. And he was sitting on the beach at Queenscliff in his car doing some work calls before heading into work. And so I was late for breakfast and I can only say to Michelle, "I'm sorry, the Premier of New South Wales just gave me a call and I had to attend to some business. So therefore I'm late for you and then I'm late for the next appointment," and on it goes. But anyway, that's life.
See, this encapsulates where you are, and that's why I wanted to do that.
How did I get here?
Well, I don't know, because let's go. These things always start better at the start, Lainey. Growing up as a tomboy on the northern beaches of Sydney, how are you now have the Premier ringing you and demanding your time is an extraordinary thing.
Mike Baird's a good bloke, that's why.
Does he surf?
Yeah, he's a great surfer.
Oh, there you go.
He loves his surfing.
Does he?
Yeah.
I'll vote for him next. If I ever move to New South Wales, he's got my vote.
And
that's
the thing
about
was, we were talking about funding and organising meetings, and then all of a sudden he stops and goes, "Hang on, look at that left-hander peeling along the..."
Did he?
Squirrel.
What a dude.
Yeah, he loves
it. So where did it start, Lainey? What are your first... We normally start here with what are your first memories of your sport or first memories of life in general, but is your first memories of a beach or a house or a person or a...
My first memories are of a beach when I was about 6 months old,
I think.
Yeah, being plonked on the sand, in the sun, feeling the sun on my skin and the sand under my toes and feeling the water on my skin and just going, "Well, I'm alive and I belong here."
Cool.
And this is where I shall stay.
So this is at Northern Beaches?
This is at Manly.
Right.
Yeah, and Mantown, how I like to prefer to...
Mantown.
I prefer to call it Mantown.
So when did you first jump on a craft?
Because I jumped on a skateboard when I was 3.
Right, and massive tomboy.
Yeah.
Massive tomboy.
I was nothing but a tomboy. I wanted to be a boy.
Did
it
you?
It was just easier.
Yeah.
So everything my big brother Jason did, I wanted to do better, and I did.
Were you good on a skateboard?
I was good on a skateboard. Yeah, I loved it. I used to walk all the way to the top of the hill at the end of our street and just fly down, and Dad would see these long blonde hair fly past the window, and he'd walk out onto the balcony and just listen, just in the event that I may have hit a car or come unstuck. But then he'd see me walk back up.
Back to the top of the hill?
Back to the top of the hill and do it all again. Faster, Daddy, faster. And then I used to also do it. We had a big grass hill that we used to run to the top of and fly down it as well on skateboards and go-karts that, of course, you always forget to put the brakes on when you make your own go-karts.
Of course you do. Yeah. Of course you do. And your first time into the water, can you remember a first craft, a first board, a first wave?
It was a foamy bought from KFC back in the...
KFC?
I think so. Remember when I used to make those foamies with
do.
The blue...
I do.
Yeah, that used to rash the crap out of your stomach.
That's it.
The plastic, red plastic single fin, yeah. I started in the best equipment. And so I surfed that. And until that blue Hessian cover fell apart, and then I just... rode the styrofoam board. And I surfed a foamy from the age of 4 until I was about 13.
Really?
So I was on a foamy for a good 9 years and then decided it was time to step up.
Was it instant love? Was it instant?
Yes.
It was.
It was
the feeling,
love.
The lifestyle.
The freedom of expression, the lifestyle, the sense of belonging, the lack of fear, the absence of judgment. The whole thing.
The absence of judgment.
Yeah, the surfing, just being in the water and being in the ocean and also now I reflect on that and with a little sense of, a greater sense of self-awareness and consciousness is that it was surrendering. So I'm a self-confessed control freak when I'm on land. So going in the ocean and surfing teaches me to relinquish control.
Right.
Because I'm in a force and a power way more powerful than I am. So I have to relinquish and just go with the flow. Let it go.
Different times then, and I love it now that, you know, I'm teaching my daughter to surf and half the kids out there learning to surf are girls.
Yes, isn't it fantastic? Apparently it's my fault.
Well, it's not a fault. It's a wonderful thing, Lane. Mm-hmm. And I guess now, you know, when I started trying to learn to surf, a girl was a rarity in the surf, and now it's probably where I am in Victoria, where the water's a bit colder, probably 25% a girls now, which is fantastic. In your days in Manly, I'm thinking it wasn't 25%, mate.
It was 1%. That was me.
That was you, the little tomboy.
Why fit in when you're born to stand out,
that's
right?
That's it. That's exactly so, right. That's you.
That's me. And so when I started surfing, there was occasionally Pam Burridge would show up occasionally because she surfed at Manly. And then there was another...
Was she a goddess to you?
You know, I never had goddesses, I never had idols or heroes because I never wanted to be like anybody else. I just wanted to be the best version of me. So I never had these heroes that I stuck on my wall and went, I'm going to be just like them. I didn't want to be like anyone else.
You're a freak.
I just wanted to be
You're
me.
You're a freak, eventually. I just wanted to be me. So what were the boys like? Did you have to prove yourself? How
of
do you prove
course.
Yourself?
Yeah. As a girl growing up in a male-dominated environment, you've always got to prove yourself. And unfortunately, I had that at home as well. So with my dad and my brother, my mother died when I was 6, so I've grown up in this male-dominated environment. So the beach and the surf was just an extension of that. And but fortunately, I found my tribe very early. I found this group of guys that I hung out with and felt accepted by and belonged to and had a good time with. You know, we became this foundation of support and understanding and a group that we spoke our own vernacular. You know, we had our own jargon and language just to communicate with, and we just enjoyed each other's company. And then when I started surfing on a fiberglass surfboard, that group expanded, of course, because I had to move up to the northern or mid section of the beach.
To move up the beach.
Move up the beach, yes, because I could no longer surf in the southern corner because that's where the flags are. And that's when I found an even bigger tribe. And then they had the confidence in me to start our own board riders club because none of us wanted to go all the way up to the northern end of the beach where QBC, Queenscliff Board Riders Club, was surfing. So we started our own and they made me president. And I was the only girl in the club, but I was the president of the club, being somewhat organised and a bit of a control freak. So I was happy to do that. That club was called Manly Pipe Riders and we surfed right off that first southern pipe. There's two stormwater pipes that divide the beach. I started that club right there and generated sponsorship and I think we only ran it for a couple of years and then I decided I just don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to join QBC.
That's when you needed the premier then. It was probably like Neville Ran or someone like that you needed to get on board.
No, I think it was even before.
Was it? Yeah. You mentioned your mum and I read your book again probably 3 weeks ago, Beneath the Waves. It's a fantastic book, Lainey.
Thank you.
I got it on iBooks, actually, so you joined the revolution.
Yeah, the digital revolution.
Yeah, it is. And your upbringing was different to the average person, to say the least. And it's too private a thing for me to ask you directly about. So you just explain it to me from where you sit, Lainey, I think is the best way to do it, if you don't mind.
Okay. As opposed to how Hamish wrote it in the paper a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah.
I read that and it was really, you're talking about an article written by Hamish McLaughlin in the Herald Sun and I found it really confronting.
Oh, I bet. And, you know, because I own my story and I'm quite vulnerable and
why I can't ask you about it.
Yeah, right. So it's interesting. I neglect to have that level of empathy for people who are reading my story because I'm so okay with it. I just expect everyone else to be okay with
it. But you understand how
I completely understand
private it would be.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Like we're mates, but we don't sit around and discuss our families over 19 beers type of thing.
Exactly. Last weekend, I was the MC at a Lifeline ball and John Brogdon got up and spoke about his suicide attempt.
Wow.
And I found that quite confronting, even though I've known John for many, many years, even before he was Premier or the Leader of the Opposition, actually, in New South Wales. And I just went, wow. I was actually surprised at how restless I was with, even though I knew all about it and had been good friends with him. So I totally get where you're coming from. So in the effect of not wanting to make you feel uncomfortable sitting here in the studio.
Well, no, it won't make me uncomfortable. It'll make me uncomfortable to ask you directly about it.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, let me tell you. So I was adopted at birth and I was conceived, according to my mother, my biological mother, who I met when I was 27 years of age, she informed me that I was conceived through date rape. And at the time, I didn't know how I felt about that because it just seemed incomprehensible. Mm. You know, I've just heard from a person saying that she's my mother and then telling me how I came into this world. And so, yeah, I can see why that's pretty confronting as a 17-year-old woman being raped and then deciding to go through the pregnancy and giving birth and then being told by her family that actually being forced by her family to give me up, which I'm incredibly grateful for because I was adopted by such a beautiful family. And my mother, who adopted me, Valerie, and my dad, Neil, and my brother, Jason, were a beautiful family. And my mother, Valerie, couldn't have any more kids after some complications after giving birth to Jason. So they always wanted a boy and a girl. And 10 months was all it took after they applied. By the way, you know, Valerie got the phone call and went, your daughter's ready to be picked up.
Really?
Come and get her.
Because apparently these days it's such a difficult process.
Apparently it's a nightmare, which is why Deborah Lee Furness and Adopt Change are working so hard to change legislation. Anyway, they went and picked me up and brought me home and the rest is history, as they say. But when I was 6 years old, we had the deep misfortune of losing Valerie to she had a brain hemorrhage during cosmetic surgery, undetected high blood pressure.
Out of the blue.
Devastating. Absolutely devastating. And as a six-year-old, I didn't understand the concept of losing someone as so impactful as your mother. And
I bet your old man at the time.
Yeah, I know. And Dad's so resilient and so strong. And I mean, my dad's been through hell and back. He's one of my greatest inspirations. He lost Valerie when I was six. He then remarried when I was 24 to Christina and lost her when I was 31 to breast cancer. So he's watched two loves of his life pass away in front of him. And then he's had three kids to three different mothers. So he's had a rough trot, but he still gets up every day and runs the length of Manly Beach and gives life a good...
Neil?
Yep, Neil. Yep, he's my rock. Anyway, when I was six, that happened. But when I was eight, that's when Dad told me I was adopted. And
do you remember that conversation?
I do remember that conversation because it was heart-wrenching, not heartbreaking, just heart-wrenching because I felt... And, you know, it's our thoughts that create how we feel about something. You know, our thoughts lead to emotions and actions, and then those actions determine the results that you produce in your life. And I love to refer to the difference between having a victim mentality versus a victor mentality. And the victim mentality is a mentality of, I can't believe this is happening to me. I can't believe I was rejected at birth. I can't believe my own mother didn't want me. I can't believe that I feel, why have I been so abandoned, so rejected? I can't believe, this is not right, right? And I don't know what to do about this. And that's the victim mentality.
That's the victim.
The victor goes, all right, I'm not going to go through this for nothing. I'm going to turn this into something positive. I understand that life has ebbs and flows. And of course, I didn't have this conscious awareness as an 8-year-old, but I do remember sitting there going, I'm not deserving of love. So how can I make myself deserving of love? I know I'll become a world champion. Everyone will love me.
That's it, right?
That's
there.
It.
That's the crux of you winning 7 world surf titles.
That's right, the crux of me winning 6 in a row. The 7th one, completely different mentality.
Well, we'll get to that.
Yeah, so the 1-6 was in survival mode and 7 was in ease and grace.
To prove that you were worthy.
To prove that I was deserving of love.
Bloody hell, that's intense. Let's,
yeah, it was
let's
intense.
Let's be honest.
Like, yeah.
That's intense.
And I was intense. Yeah.
Yeah. The first time I met you was intense, and I'll get to.
Okay,
was,
I look forward to reflecting on that.
Intense character as well.
I was an intense person.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Yeah.
I can't deny who I was. And I do reflect on those periods of my life and go, my God, who was that?
Well, maybe that's what you needed.
That's what people ask you. Do you think you could have, would have, should have, if you weren't like that? And I say, I can't answer that question because it's what I believed.
So.
It's what I believed I needed to be.
Yep.
But quite honestly, now, if I ever fall back into that survival mode, I seek proof of the opposite because I know it doesn't have to be that hard. You know, when your expectations are lofty, they're up here in the sky and life keeps delivering way down here on the table, everything in the middle is pain, suffering and struggle. And if you continue to succeed despite all the pain and suffering and struggle, you believe that the only way to achieve your expectations is through pain, suffering and struggle.
Mm.
And I was a self-fulfilling prophecy of that from 1972 until I won my 6th world title in 2003.
Which, as I said, we'll get to, which I can only believe then when you've changed that mentality, it must be one of the great release of your life to almost get your life back. But, lady.
It's releasing a pressure valve.
Oh, a massive pressure valve, especially when it's sort of 20 odd years of build-up.
Mm.
So your surfing is going well.
As in now?
Not now.
Oh, we're reflecting still.
Then, we're still
back then,
in
yes.
reflection mode.
Surfing was going great. Well, I thought so. Until I went and found a surf coach.
Well, so not naturally amazing.
No.
Are you a hard worker?
Yes.
Combined with some talent. You're not one of those athletes that's just naturally...
There's no raw talent within me.
Right.
No, oh, that's a lie because
I have
a great amount of balance. Yeah. I'm a really physically balanced, not emotionally and mentally balanced, especially back then.
At least you got one.
More so now, but the physical balance was definitely...
So when did you start to become good advantage. And people be aware and you maybe become aware that this is what you can do?
Around about 15 or 16 was when I started.
You're still at school then?
I'm still in high school.
Yep.
Yep, year 10 and 11. I started competing in the regional events when I was 15. I came dead last in the first event I ever competed in, and that shattered my confidence.
Last?
But yeah, dead last. And as far last as you could possibly come.
How many are in it?
Oh, it was actually a charity event, like a fundraising charity event to raise money for a surfer that had lost his life a few months prior. And it was an organised event that a lot of people competed in, and it was a men and women's tournament. And I think there must have been about 40 women and 120 guys or something. And my first heat, I was so nervous. My board felt like it was made of cement. Huh. I couldn't turn. And I was so disheartened.
Welcome to my world.
Yeah. And you're teaching your daughter to surf.
Yeah, well.
I'm concerned.
Yeah, so am I.
Yeah. She needs to be too.
Yeah.
Anywho. And I was so nervous and so disheartened by my performance that I actually decided to go back out and prove to myself that I can surf. And after the next free surf, I went, okay, I can still do this. I'm not going to allow myself to be defined by that one poor performance. I'm going to continue on. And so I then started competing in the regional events. And the Surfing Australia way back in the 80s had developed this high-performance program, and it was a talent identification program, and they took me along with all these other kids or girls from around the country. So, and they still do it, but it's Elaine Beachley camp now. It's I mentor and coach all the two best under 16-year-olds from every state once a year up in out at the High Performance Centre in Casuarina. And back in the 80s, it was a demountable at Lennox Head.
Times have changed, as
times
we said.
Have changed.
Good wave, though. Still a good wave.
Still a great wave. There's a bit of marine life out there that's causing
there
a bit
is.
Of havoc. Anyway.
I can't get, when I finish surfing, I can't get back on those rocks without dinging myself on my board every single time.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Right. Do you turn your board over?
Oh, I turn my board over, I turn myself over, I get hit in the head. Anyway.
Yeah. They're precarious, those
they
rocks.
Are. Yeah, and at the moment, as you said, with the marine life. But
we digress. I'm a Gemini. I run off on all sorts of random tangents.
Which is perfect.
Stick
for
with
podcast.
Me. I know, right?
That's the thing.
Squirrel. Oh, look, a shiny thing. Anyway, I went to this high performance camp and I learned how to structure a heat plan. I learned how to sit and watch the conditions and time sets and work out where the best ways were and create a plan B. And I put that into practice at the next regional, the state, was it? Yeah, it was the regional scholastic titles and I won them. And then I went to the state scholastic titles and I won them. And then I went to the national scholastic titles and had a horrible time. I was the new girl on the team, two girls on the team, seven or eight guys, was harassed, threatened, intimidated, bullied,
no fun.
It shattered me. I'm strong and I'm resilient and I'm tenacious and I can stand up and give it as good as I get it, but they just gave it incessantly and I couldn't take it. And that made me reassess my path to a world championship. That made me reassess my path to the pro tour. So what it made me do is I avoided the amateur scene from then on. I didn't want anything to do with team surfing. I'm only going to compete in individuals contests that don't revolve around having a team to travel somewhere and do something because I didn't like it.
So you turned pro.
So I turned pro. Yeah. I was still in high school and I didn't really, I mean, I turned pro and what that meant was that gave me the ability to enter into the big pro events. And so all that really meant was paying a prize money, paying an entry fee and paying a membership fee to the ASP. So I paid my membership fee, competed in my first event. Pee or fee, did I say?
Either way. You went in it.
I peed and I paid a fee. anyway, I came dead last in my first pro tour event.
Again.
Up against Pauline Mensah. And she only beat me by 0.1 of a point or something. But back then, you know, that meant a lot to me.
A loss is a loss.
A loss is a loss. But it also meant I was really close. And so once again, I had to revert back to the drawing board and start all over again. I haven't really answered your question in regards to who identified your talent, or were there people who were supportive of you? And it was the guys in the water. And I surrounded myself, very fortunately, I started working when I was 14, I think, at the local surf shop.
Surf shop, of course.
And Guy Leach owned it. He was a part owner with Doug Lees. And hanging out with Guy Leach is like hanging out with a motivational quote, right?
An extraordinary man. The first time I ever sat in commentary with him in the Ironman, we had to call the call and go to gold. I'd never called a surf iron life-saving before. It's all right. You have a chat with Leachy. He comes in at 30 seconds before, in his frickin' Speedos, sits down.
At least he wasn't nude.
Well, near as. Closer. And said, all right, cock, away we go. But the time I spent on that for 3 years with him and Trevor Hendy, you'd come home every weekend just ready to charge on life.
Yeah.
Because they just, like you said, like motivational quotes, those two.
Trevor is adorable, and Leachy I refer to as one of my honesty barometers, and between the two of them I draw on their wisdom and their knowledge and their positivity and their enthusiasm for life, and just... I surround myself with people like that as much as I possibly can, because they elevate you. And so Leachy...
You trained with him too as well.
I did train with Leachy. The fun thing about training with Leachy, because I trained with him as a kid and then I came back when I was competing and trained with him again, and you have to reassure Leachy as much as he reassures you, actually more so, I think, because we were doing this underwater training and he's, you know, 6 foot and massive lungs, and so we were doing this... competition against each other where we'd go under and then see who'd get the furthest up the pool, and he'd always go 10 metres beyond me, and he's like, how good is this, Gidgey? How good am I?
Gidgey,
like,
as in Gidget. Gidget.
Yeah.
That was your nickname.
That was my nickname. He still calls me Gidgey or Gidgewa. And so, yeah, I was always going, you're awesome. You're awesome, Leachy.
Which he loves.
Which he loves.
Which he loves.
Well, he doesn't usually wait for someone to tell him.
No. My first training session with him was at Karawa, and he said, oh, we'll just go for a swim. I want you to get an idea of what it's like to compete in this. We'll just swim 100 metres out there. And it's like 6 foot onshore. And I'm like, well, I'm not exactly, you know, Libby Trickett here. And he says, oh, I'll keep an eye on you. You know, 50 metres out. He's 150 metres out. I'm thinking, oh, you're keeping an eye on me, are you?
Yeah, thanks, Leachy.
Thanks for your support.
Yeah.
Thanks for that, Leachy.
But, as you know, there was people like him and other surfers around. Barton Lynch was a great mentor. Pam Burridge also. Stuart Entwistle. There was other world champions and other surfers who were in the water who were very honest and supportive and encouraging. So they were the kind of people that I always sought. I was always looking for counsel and guidance and support from. And those guys and girls were constantly elevating me and nurturing my talent and also telling me, okay, that's looking good, but you may want to do something different or try this or try that. And so for every one of the guys that paddled up to me and were giving me crap, you know, there was a lot of hostility and threats in the water in the 70s and 80s. There was a lot of pulling of leg ropes and pushing and cutting off and spitting water and, you know, people growling in my face, guys paddling up to me and saying, you're a girl, get out of the water, all that kind of hostility. I refer to those people as my dream thieves and life vampires. They're the ones that really don't add any value to your life. And at times, of course, you want to be loved, you want to be liked, you want to fit in, you want to be accepted. And when you get surrounded by all this hostility and negativity, you start to question and doubt yourself. So I would always paddle away from that. When I had the confidence within myself, I would paddle away from that and go and sit with the guys who believed in me and supported me. So for every five of the life vampires or the dream thieves, there was one who was the honesty barometer, and I always gravitated towards that one. There were days when there was no honesty barometers in the water and I would paddle in with my tail between my legs and tears in my eyes. So you don't always have the courage to stand up or the conviction to stand up and fight.
Plenty more of Lane Beachley still to come, but first, a preview of next week's episode of the Howie Games, featuring one of the most stylish batsmen of the modern era. Could this bloke play Damien Martin?
Sometimes whether you burn out or you're just done, you know, in something, you know, it's hard to explain when you're out of it 10 years, but at that stage it was just, I had to get out. I was just done mentally, physically. I just felt that I was going to go down a path where, you know, yeah, you know, and you know, like being on these tours, you're sitting in rooms by yourself. You know, everybody thinks it's so glamorous, okay, but there is times where you're just sitting alone, sitting around, you know, with your thoughts, whether you're, you know, you're depressed about making no runs or whatever it is, it's hard.
That's Damien Martin coming up next week. Now, please subscribe to the Howie Games so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. And if you have 2 minutes, it'd be great if you could give us a rating on iTunes. That would be just dandy. Back to Lane.
Have you read Andre Agassi's book?
Open.
open.
Love it.
And it, the thing that strikes me about that is it just, I think the first 30 pages are as good a sport book as you'll read.
Yes.
You just can't comprehend how much self-doubt he has.
Mm.
Reading your book again, which has got a lot of your diary entries in it,
mm-hmm.
even when you were on top of the world, you were doubting yourself constantly, Lane.
Mm.
That really surprised me.
Self-deprecating too.
Yeah.
And then trying to make up for it somehow by putting others down. I mean, I did have a lot of self-doubt and a lot of internal.
Why when you became good, why when you became a multiple, which we'll get to, why then do you still question whether you're good enough when you've got 3, 4, 5, 6 world titles under your belt?
Comparison.
With?
Yourself, others, worrying about what everyone else is thinking.
Okay.
It's just that desperation to be good enough.
Can't be much fun when you're sitting in a hotel room in Biarritz by yourself and you've just got beat and you're just saying, well, I'm no good anymore, I've lost this, I don't like the way I look,
and then
I don't
you've
like
got
the way I surf.
Yeah, and then you've got the media weighing into it as well.
Yeah.
So you become so distracted by what everyone else is thinking and saying that you stop self-defining. So when you're not self-defined, when you're not aware of your own values and how you define yourself, then you become conditioned by external circumstances and you continue to buy into those. So when everything's good, you're up. When everything's down, you're down, and it's this emotional, physical, mental roller coaster. There's no consistency, and if you've succeeded in that pattern, you will continue to manifest that pattern in your life.
So when you win your first world title in 98, you win your first world title, and then you say you won 6 on a trot.
Mm.
You've just won your first world title. Take me to that moment then, how you've just, you know, you've just become the champ, the best in the world. Mm. What you wanted to achieve to be worthy of the love, etc. Are you worthy of love at that stage?
No, no, you're not yet.
Right.
No.
Why not? You've got there, Lane.
Well, that was just part of the journey.
A lot of people think that was
the
enough.
Yeah. Well, I've done obviously it. I don't.
Yeah.
So
obviously.
I remember it was funny when you just asked me, take me back to that moment. I physically felt being there just then, and I just went, all I feel is a sense of relief. Like, oh, thank God that's done. I've done it now. But it wasn't a sense of complacency. It was just relief. Like, okay, whew, I can stop saying it. I can stop saying I want to be world champion. I can now say I am a world champion. And the power of I am is they are the two most powerful words in the English language, I am, because it's a declaration to the universe, and what you put after them shapes your destiny and your reality. So if you, every time you use the words I am and you state this declaration, you're going to be emotionally supported in that. So if you wake up in the morning saying I am tired, then that's the declaration and the universe will always support you in what you want. And so I am a world champion fueled my confidence and fueled my belief in myself. And at the time, Ken Bradshaw, who was my partner and supporter and coach and mentor and board shaper and everything, he went, you are the best in the world and you will be the best of the best. And that's what I always wanted to be, the best of the best. I never allowed the history books to dictate to me what I could or could not achieve. I just wanted to be the best of the best. So what I did was I looked at the history books and went, well, what does the history say about the best? Well, Lisa Anderson won 4 in a row.
Yep.
Let's go for 5. And after I won my 5th, Kelly Slater won 5 in a row. Well, I've matched him. I need to be better than that. So I won 6.
We used to play this game at uni. It just struck me when you mentioned Kelly Slater. I hadn't thought of this for years, where it was like a game when we'd be having beers. Imagine if at that stage Shane Warne could bat like Steve Waugh. Mm-hmm. Imagine what you'd be out with. And I remember one night rolling out that, imagine if Lane Beachley and Kelly Slater got together, what their child could do on a surfboard. And everyone's like, whoa, yes, I think that was the overall winner.
Really?
But you wanted to go past Kelly.
I don't think Kelly would need me to add any
no,
any more value to the child that he would produce, honestly.
No, I think he'll be okay.
He's incredible on his own.
I think he'll be okay. Yeah. So the first time we met, you won't remember it, a show called Sports World on Channel 7 hosted by Joanna Griggs.
Yes.
And at that stage, it could have been Dermot Brereton or Paul Salmon, etc. I was a very, very junior producer, and my job was to look after the guests. And you came in, it's probably 2001, so you're probably a 3 or 4-time world champion.
That's right, yeah.
And you come in with this enormous fella.
Yeah.
Who is Ken Bradshaw. Yeah. And I don't know him, except that he's your partner at the time.
Looks a lot like Buzz Lightyear.
Yeah, huge man, physical presence. And I start talking to him, about surfing 1-foot waves at Ocean Grove. And he's telling me about surfing 40-foot waves at Jaws, and I thought, wow, this is a remarkable character. Mm. You guys had a remarkable relationship. Mm. Your personal relationship is yours, but the relationship that you had to push you to get that five is extraordinary, I reckon.
It is extraordinary. And the great thing was is that Ken, as supportive and loving and nurturing as he was also really good at mitigating distractions. So he was really good at identifying my weaknesses. And that's what athletes do. Athletes are always looking for constructive feedback because we don't want to know what we're doing right. We want to know what we're doing wrong so we can fix it and get on with it and let it go and keep moving. And a lot of people just focuses on their strengths and they become their weaknesses. So you need a healthy balance of both. Unfortunately, I wasn't very balanced in that. I was constantly focusing on the weakness, which also fueled my lack of belief and self-doubt. So I still made it work. And so when I first started dating Ken, you know, he was positive and he noticed, you know, I was the most consistent competitor in Hawaii, but there was still a lot of improvements to make. You know, I loved big waves, and big waves suited my surfing style because I'm quite a powerful surfer. Even though I'm pint-sized in stature, I'm gargantuan in spirit.
In power.
Yeah,
in power.
And I love surfing powerful waves. So Hawaii really suited me and I loved being there. And Ken lived right on the beachfront at Sunset Beach. So I fell in love with Hawaii and fell in love with Ken, fell in love with the process of just constantly and relentlessly pursuing improvement.
Relentless. That's the word that I get again from you reading Beneath the Waves.
I was relentless.
Relentless, the campaign you guys set out.
We did set out quite a fierce campaign, and that's when I was quoted as having the compassion of a tiger shark. I was fierce, very fierce. And when I reflect back on that, that ferocity actually and that fierceness and that relentless pursuit cost me a lot. I mean, everyone sees the glamour and the awards and the accolades, the championships and, you know, the fame and the fortune and all that comes with it. But for me, I also acknowledge that it cost me my quality of health, cost me my quality of happiness, cost me my quality of relationships, cost me my quality of joy. And so there's a lot of my world title campaign that I'm not proud of. And when I won my seventh world title, the one thing that I promised myself and the one pact that I made was every time I walked out of the water, I would be proud of myself. And I was proud of the competitor I'd become. I was proud of the human being I'd morphed into. Mm. And I was proud of my effort. And you can't expect anything more than that. But because my expectations were so unrealistic, and so were Ken's, just made life really, really hard, really, really challenging. So I'd come out of the water coming second and bawl my eyes out. And everyone thought I was being a bad loser. But I was so distraught because I'd let Ken down and then I'd let myself down that it just created this snowball effect and this
we're here in Australian sport, we just take it 1 week at a time.
Yeah.
You guys set up a four-year
campaign.
So you can't enjoy two.
Campaign.
Well, you can't enjoy two or three or four because you're still on the way to five.
And when I go in as a motivational speaker and a workshop facilitator teaching people about what it takes to sustain success, one of the things that you must do to sustain success is celebrate success.
Which you weren't doing.
I don't remember my second world title. I don't remember winning it because I didn't celebrate it.
Because you're already under your...
I was already on my
third.
Yeah. So, but after I won my first one, I celebrated it, I anchored it. And when you anchor it, it stimulates adrenaline and a hormone response that actually fills you full of happiness and joy. And you're like, oh, I like feeling this way. Then that enables you to maintain your motivation towards putting in the work and the effort and going through the ebbs and flows of success and failure to achieve your ultimate dreams. One, tick, got it. Two, tick, got it. Three, tick, got it. After the third one, I went, hey, this is pretty remarkable. I need to start celebrating. And I started having parties. Ken didn't appreciate it, but that's what I really wanted to do. And it was during my fifth world title campaign that I realized, you know, I need to get out of this relationship. This isn't serving me anymore. I mean, we were a formidable duo and he taught me so much in surfing. And it was actually one afternoon we were doing an interview during we were filming a movie together called The Billabong Odyssey. And the guy asked me, what has Ken taught you? And I could rattle off a million things Ken's taught me about big wave surfing and about focus and discipline and dedication and breath training and reading weather maps. And like I've just learned toe-in surfing and, you know, navigating my way around really big open ocean swells and things. And when he said, so what's Lane taught you? And he couldn't answer the question.
Come on, Ken.
Yeah, come on, Ken.
Come on, Ken.
And then he went, to surf small waves?
Ooh.
And I went, okay, this is not working. We're not contributing to each other's life equally here. It's time to move on. It was really hard to get out of there, but I did. I made the break. And I'm incredibly grateful for the relationship that we shared and the knowledge that we shared and the love that we shared. And the one thing I recognised throughout that whole campaign with Ken is it's really important to have that one person in your corner that's honest with you, that can eliminate distractions, can identify some of your weaknesses and bring them to your attention in a loving, compassionate way that's not unrealistic and doesn't project their own expectations onto you. It's really important that you have that person in your corner that you can be, that they can be that sounding board and that pillar of unconditional support.
So when Ken's playing that role and somehow you explain it to me, your mum comes back into your life.
Oh, yes.
And Ken's saying, hang on. We've got world titles to win.
You're a distraction,
yeah,
woman.
Yeah, my girl doesn't want distractions.
Mm.
How did all that happen, Lane?
Yeah, not well.
Was it a phone call or an email? Or did you go looking for it?
She came looking for me, and it was around about the time that Google had appeared, and she Googled me after she contacted Dad, and she managed to find Dad, called him. He put two and two together. He realised that, yeah, this woman's legit. This is Lane's mother. Told her that I was away. She assumed I was a journalist and she Googled me and realised I was about to win my second world title. And then she called me and then the communication started and then I agreed to meet her.
Did you want to take the call? Was it weird taking the call?
I didn't know it was her. I just,
oh,
it was before
you, just
you had
the phone.
Yeah, well, this was before mobile phones.
Oh. So how did she introduce herself?
No, actually, it's not before mobile phones. This was 1999. So I did have a mobile phone, but she called my home phone.
So how did she introduce herself?
Hi, Elaine. This is Maggie. I'm your mum.
Oh.
And on she went. And I instantly put down the phone. And see, the thing with adoptees, from my own personal experience and from a lot of adoptees that I speak to, we have this, a lot of us have this unconscious fear of rejection because we've been rejected. And it tends to play out in two ways. You either reject others or you act in a way that gives people a reason to reject you. And you become a self-fulfilling prophecy because, as I was saying to Michelle this morning, most of us would rather be right than happy. Right? So I told you so. I'm right. Okay? And I rejected my mother because I wanted to be right and I didn't want to believe her story. I didn't want to believe that I was conceived through rape. I didn't want to believe most of the story. And then I had to own up to that. And it's taken me a long time to do that. But I agreed to meet her and I went to San Francisco. She lives in America and she left Australia right after she gave birth to me and hasn't come back. And to get married.
The first time you saw her, did you see yourself in her?
Yeah, I was like looking in a mirror in
so
17
you knew
years.
That's my mum.
There was no
you
question.
You didn't have to say you were in a red jumper or whatever.
No.
That's my mum.
That's my mum. Yeah, and Ken was concerned. He's like, oh, is she a gold digger or a fame digger? You know, being super
good Ken.
Yeah, good Ken.
To protect you.
Lower down the wingspan, Buzz Lightyear. Take a deep breath. You cannot fly around this room with your eyes closed. And so he allowed me to go on my own and I went and met her with her. And we actually just met at the airport in San Fran. I flew in, flew out. And yeah, there was no question she was my mother. It was good to meet her. But then when she showed up at the surf contest, he knew how I felt about it. And I hadn't explained that to Maggie, my mother, but Ken and I had very open flowing forms of communication. We spoke very openly and candidly together and I told him exactly how I felt. And so men love to fix everything and they love to protect the ones that they love.
That's what we do.
That's what you do.
In theory.
So, in theory. Which tends to sometimes compromise certain things. So in order of in Ken's paternal nurturing ways, he wanted to fix it, so he just cleared it out. Stay away. Timing's everything. Yours sucks. Get out of the way.
You're affecting your performance.
You're affecting your performance. We might not win this event.
Ooh.
Yeah. And it wasn't until Mike Monroe walked into my lounge room and went, Lane, this is your life, and I told him to get...
Oh.
When Ken walked out into the stage, I didn't know Ken was there. You don't know who's coming on.
No.
Ken walked out and sat down and said, we're going for our fifth this year. I just went, okay, Ken.
We.
I appreciate your support, Ken. And Anna Mears said it beautifully after Rio. She said, a good coach can change your ways. A great coach can change your life. And Ken was a great coach. He changed my life. But he had to realise that I was not his life. He had to continue living his own life. And I felt like he was vicariously living through my life.
And if you don't mind me asking now, you and your mum?
Me and my mum, it's still tenuous.
Is it a phone call? Is it an email?
It's an email. Okay. I got a call from, actually she emailed me on my wedding anniversary on our, Kirk and I just celebrated our 6th wedding anniversary on the 10th of the 10th of the 10th. And that's when we got married. And so we won't forget. And she sent me an email just congratulating me. But it's basically 2 lines.
Okay.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's a mother-daughter relationship by any stretch of the imagination.
One other thing that Ken, being a big Hawaiian man, he probably took you to a level of big wave surfing that, well, let's be honest, that no woman has done before. There's still that vision of you at, I think it's ours.
Oh,
is
yes.
It?
Yeah, it's ours.
Tell me about surfing big waves.
So Ken was a pioneer. He was a big wave surfing pioneer. He's a Texan. And so he left Texas. And
all the good waves he used to pick up in Texas.
Yeah, especially when the barges come through.
Yeah, right. Epic, dude. Gnarly, bro.
Pumping. And so, yeah, he followed his dream to Hawaii because he used to be a gridiron player and he followed his dream. It's funny, you know, I think about Ken and his relationship with his father and typical fathers who just want the best for their kids, but in that protection mechanism, that survival mode mechanism, they say, keep it as a hobby, son, because they don't want their kids to fail.
Mm.
So they're like, no, you know, get a real job. And Ken just wanted to prove to his dad that he could make it. And he won a couple of really big events. And I think his dad finally got it. Similar to my husband, Kirk, who plays for NXS, his dad always said, keep it as a hobby, son. And then they went on to become the biggest band in the world.
Yeah.
So
thanks for that, Dad.
Thanks, Dad. Sound advice. Fortunately, my dad never said keep it as a hobby.
So he got you out into enormous...
He did.
What's the biggest wave you surf lane?
50 foot. And actually, Ken wasn't there that day, but he...
How many stories is that?
5 stories.
5 stories high.
Yeah.
He wasn't there, was he? Because no. I think it was a big storm and...
He was at a trade show or something in Florida.
So what's it like to surf a wave that's 5 stories high?
Frightening.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is there any other thing or it's just frightening?
Adrenalizing.
Is it?
Is that a word?
Yeah. Well, you've made it up. So when you surf 50-foot waves, you can call it whatever your body likes. Let's be completely frank.
Dynamicism.
Right. That's a good one too.
Yeah. Dynamic.
Is it just...
It was amazing. It was adrenalizing.
Can you still picture it?
I can. I can still feel it. I can still feel standing on top of that 5-story building. I was so full of adrenaline, excitement, fear. I was so alert. I was so alive. Every cell in my body was right there. I was so... And the good thing about it was I'm a Gemini, so I have, you know, the average human being has between 50 to 70,000 thoughts a day. As a Gemini, I reckon I have about 90. And so...
Minimum. Minimum. I reckon that's by lunchtime for you.
Yeah, true. And so it silenced everything. I was just completely and 100% in the moment.
So there's nothing else?
There's nothing else going on. And so I went, Heaven. Oh, this is amazing. And then right as I went to commit, the first word that came into mind was, don't fall. And I'm thinking, the last thing I want to think about is what I don't want to happen.
Yeah.
So I had the presence of mind to reverse it and ask myself, Lane, what do you want? And the first thing that came to mind was just stay standing. I thought that's a good outcome. I'll go with that.
And
I made it.
Do you sit back that night and do you have a feeling of satisfaction when you achieve something like that as opposed to a trophy?
Yes, absolutely. A sense of personal satisfaction, physical satisfaction. See, when Ken rode the biggest wave that he'd ever ridden, which was 86 foot.
So we're talking 9 stories now.
Yeah. When he rode that wave, he had post-big wave depression because he thought he was never going to ride something like that ever again.
So he was flat. That's as big as it gets.
That's as good as it gets.
Really?
It's much like the Eagles. They gave up after Hotel California because they thought that's as good as it gets. It's not going to get any better than this.
Well, if you're riding 9-story wave... Then
yeah, but why are you placing those limitations on yourself? How do you know what's going to happen? How do you know what's going to happen to technology? What's going to happen to big wave surfing? Now we're seeing 100-foot waves in Portugal being ridden. Yeah. So there's girls that have gone on and ridden bigger waves than me. But at the time, that was the record and I didn't call anyone to let anyone know I was out there. So I don't have any vision of it, but it's in my head. I could plug a USB into my ears and download it, feed it to you.
Well, the
but I actually share it in my motivational speaking. I share that story because I love it. It takes me back there and because it's so clear in my head, I'm able to take people on that journey with me. I love it. It's good fun.
Last week on the Howie Game, the great white guru, Greg Norman.
Daddy is still banging on about how tight he is with the shark, Big Penguin.
Tell me about it, Pickle. I don't reckon old Sharky would know Daddy if he popped up in his cornflakes.
True dat, Pango. Anyway, it's a ripper ep.
At the end of the day, it is just a game. It's just the sport is just sport. And there's always going to be somebody who's going to be better than you. And there's always going to be a lot of people who are a lot worse off than you. So, you know, when I look back at it, I go and I walk down the trophy hall with my grandson and start talking about it. You know, those are the things that that will be very, very powerfully reflected in my years to come.
Check out Greg and the rest of our back catalogue.
But now back to Lane.
Now, Laney, you've already been really good with your time, and the producer of the Howie Games, the great MJ, has walked in.
Michael Jackson.
Yes, Michael James. And he's like this morning, he's like, oh, will Kirk be there? He's a
what,
big
am I
NXS
not
man.
Enough for you, MJ?
Well, you are for me, as you well
Thank
know.
Thank you, Howie.
But, Lane,
not
I remember,
that it matters to me.
I remember reading about it, and I thought, Gidget, the girl at the beach, and there's this sort of pasty rock star type with a Clark Gable moustache. this is just, this is new idea making things up again, like
totally.
Leighton and Beck.
Yep. Absolutely. It was a complete facade.
Where'd you meet him? Like, how did you meet him?
You know what? Well, when we did the Celebrity Grand Prix together.
Yes.
What year was that? Many years ago, back in the early
2000s. I wasn't a celebrity, but you were. That's all I remember.
Yeah, well, you were. You were celebrity enough to be in the race.
Yeah.
John Stevens was in there that year.
Right.
Right. And I met John Stevens and got to know him really well doing the Celebrity Grand Prix. And at the time, he was the lead singer or frontman of NXS.
Mm.
And so I've been an NXS fan since I was a teenager. Of course, I love the band. Every Aussie does.
Mm.
And so he said, I really want to introduce you to Kirk. And I said, why?
That dude with the funny mo.
Yeah, with the dorky looking guy with the glasses at the front. The stage that
hello Kirk, if you're listening,
plays saxophone, guitar, and sings like he's talented, but geez, seriously. And he said, I really think you two will get along great. And when I came home from France and I'd just broken up with Ken, I had to go over to John's house to pick up tickets to a private NXS show. And I told him, and John went, he was like clapping his hands in glee. Oh, awesome. Okay.
It's on.
It's on. I'm introducing you to Kirk next week. And you guys will get along like a house on fire. You both know what it takes to succeed and become the best in the world. You both know, you know, all the ins and outs of traveling the world and the trust and the just everything that goes on with being successful. You know, there's a lot of layers to it.
Apparently.
Yeah. Sorry, Howie. You're there. Okay. I know you're there.
Yeah, we're just still battling away.
It's all about perspective.
That's right.
So I went to this show and I stood at the front of the stage and I was looking at John Stevens going, John, you're hot, Kirk, you're so not. Like, seriously, John, can I go in with you first, please?
And hello to John Stevens.
Hello, Johnny.
Hello,
Rangy. So Rangy was adamant that Kirk and I would get along. Now, Kirk was this overweight, pasty, balding, Hawaiian shirt wearing, barefoot rock star.
And Come on, Kirky.
You can do better than that. Now he's this gorgeous, handsome, adorable, loving, nurturing husband of mine who I'm so grateful for Rangy that he saw something that both Kirk and I did not see.
First date?
Horrendous.
No good.
No connection,
Come
no
on,
chemistry,
Kirk.
No interest. I took him 10-pin bowling at DYRE.
Oh, you didn't. You are...
I'm a classy broad.
That would have got me across the line. I'm not sure if it's one of the world's biggest rock stars.
You can take the girl out of Manly. You can't take Manly out of the girl.
10-pin bowling.
10-pin bowling at DYRE.
And we, Kirk, go with
we
that.
Won one game each. I won the first one, he won the second one, and I did not let him win.
No.
As the trophy room would attest.
Right. And you would have spewed about getting beat.
I was pissed, yeah. But I wasn't drunk because we weren't allowed to drink. And the whole reason I took him to 10-pin bowling at DYR is because apparently we were both allowed to drink. But
right, you weren't allowed.
We weren't allowed. So that was off to a very slow start. Then we walked down to DY Beachfront to go for dinner. And I decided to pay for everything because I thought this guy's probably used to having to pay for everyone and everything. Mm. So I'm going to take him out. So at least I had some decorum. And all the way to DY Beachfront, he was talking about surfing and I was just shaking my head going, seriously, this guy thinks I know nothing else other. Because I'm dressed as a surf rat. I've got the blonde, you know, surfy rat hair and I'm a surf rat. I'm 5 times world champion. Of course, I love surfing, but I do have other interests in life. And he just obviously wanted to draw those long bows of relation and understanding. So he's talking surfing. I'm thinking this is going to be good. And then we get to the restaurant. Halfway through dinner, we're yawning in each other's face. There's no chemistry, no connection. There's nothing going on.
You're thinking about John Stevens.
Well, I'm thinking about Rangy. Yeah. At the time, I'd been spending a lot of time with Chris Isaac. So I'm thinking about Chris, and I'm thinking like, why am I here? Do I have to stay here any longer? Went to the bathroom, looked for a window to climb out of.
Did you really?
I did.
You make me laugh.
And while I'm sitting there, and I mean, while I'm in the bathroom looking for a window to climb out of, Kirk's sitting at the table thinking, if I just leave money and do a runner, will she notice?
Oh, Kirky was out too.
He was out. Right. We'd both tapped out. And then he's thinking, well, actually, my car's at her house, so I have to get back to her house, and I'm not going to just sit at the front and wait.
Awkward.
Awkward. So He stayed, and I walked out of the bathroom and looked at him and, oh, he's still here. Damn it. Okay, we'll continue. And the owner of the restaurant sat down with a fresh bottle of limoncello that his grandmother had made. This is an Italian restaurant on DY Beachfront. It's no longer there, unfortunately. And the three of us polished it off.
So that was what you needed?
That's all we needed, just a bit of limoncello.
So when you've had 15 glasses of that, all of a sudden Kirky was just starting to look okay?
Yeah, no, it wasn't about looking.
Right.
Had I
he was a bit more entertaining.
Had I been that shallow, I wouldn't have even gone on the first date.
Hello again to Kirk. Hope you're enjoying this episode of the Howie Games.
But what it was, just allowing us both to relax and let go and stop trying to impress each other, stop trying to look for these long bows of connection and understanding, just communicate. Okay, just have a chat. And then when we did, we really enjoyed each other's company and we dated each other for a week. On the way home, I had the horrendous hiccups and he just thought that was the most adorable thing ever. And then when we got home, I made him sit on the couch and watch Monsters, Inc.
You are a hot date.
I'm a hot date.
Two piling in Monsters, Inc. and trying to get out the bathroom window.
Painting a beautiful picture.
Yeah.
So after
wow,
all of that,
catch.
After a week, we went our own separate ways. He went off on tour to South America. I went off on tour back to Fiji and Hawaii. We came back together at Christmas and we've been together ever since. So we married 8 years later on the 10th of October 2010 and toasted with limoncello after the ceremony.
Oh, and now it's a beautiful thing.
It is a beautiful thing.
Do you play in excess at home?
I'm not allowed to play in excess at home.
Really?
He gets really self-deprecating. No, they're self-effacing. He's just really, he gets embarrassed.
So
every time he gets in my car, it's on. You know, I'm always listening to in excess. I love it. My ringtone is his saxophone solo from Never Tear Us Apart.
And doesn't like listening.
He just gets embarrassed.
Does he?
Yeah.
Embarrassed of being great.
Embarrassed of being great.
Yeah, life must be tough.
Yeah, it's a rough life. You know what? So he never used to display any of his memorabilia or any of his platinum or triple platinum trophies or anything. And so when he came to my house, my trophies are all around my house. And so when we moved in together and bought a house, we created a trophy room and it's straight to the pool room. It's directly out of the castle, but all the memorabilia is our own. No jousting sticks. And he...
You get a good price for those.
I know. Tell him he's dreaming. He was reticent to display his stuff because he thought it would intimidate people. I was like, no, be proud of what you've done.
Absolutely.
You guys worked your asses off to create the success that you had. And you even encountered rejection from the nation that fell in love with you because I don't know why, but anyway, they did. But they were still able to reinvent themselves. They lost the most... amazing, charismatic, incredibly talented lead singer. And then they were continued to persevere and they were able to reinvent themselves again. Then they did Rockstar in Excess and had JD Fortune for a while. And then they, after they lost JD, they've come back with Kieran Gribben. So they've been able to continue to maintain that sense of momentum that very few bands can do. And it's all because of the brotherhood and the timelessness of their music.
So what have you learnt from, you told me all the things you learnt from Ken.
Mm.
What did you learn from Kirk?
Well, I've learned a lot about image. I've learned a lot about organisation and structure, taking time out and giving time to yourself because I've been on the hamster wheel of insanity for way too long.
Well, we just heard about your morning at the start of the show.
Yeah, I know, right?
Crazy.
It is a bit crazy. So Kirk's taught me a lot about self-love and compassion and unconditional love and structure. Right, structure creates freedom, and he's very structured. And he's very—I sometimes call him OCD man because he's got a lot of structures in place,
which is un-rockstarish.
Very un-rockstarish, but he's just—he's a Cancerian. I don't know if you believe in the horoscope side of things, but I do because as a Gemini, I do have those two different personalities, and I'm running at 100 miles an hour, and I'm always very easily distracted. And whereas Kirk's as a Cancerian, he's a crab. He walks sideways from confrontation.
Okay.
He's very homely. He likes to keep everything clean and tidy. He's a great gardener, ironer, washer, cook,
Kirk's
shopper.
Doing the ironing.
He does the ironing, shopping, cleaning.
He's the most un-rockstar rockstar in the history of rockstardom.
Men to shame.
Does he?
Every woman needs to clone Kirk and
good on you,
take
Kirk.
It. Yeah, he's awesome. So he's taught me a lot about life and love and just happiness. You know, he's brought a lot of happiness to my life and we complement each other.
And you're happy now?
Very, yeah, very happy. He's been through his own health physical challenges as well with prostate cancer last year and that caused a bit of a speed bump, but we both got through that The good thing about Kirk is that he owns his stuff as well, and he's willing to share it with others. And that's the thing. You know, Brené Brown said it beautifully. When we deny our stories, they define us. But when we own our stories, we get to write the ending.
Right.
And if you continue to be defined by all these things, then you're never in control. Well, you're never in control anyway. But you're never going to own it, and you're never going to be able to be the author of your life. And we are the authors of our life. But as long as we're allowing all these external circumstances to dictate our own self-worth, then we're never going to be good enough. And that's what I was in my six world titles. I was just never good enough.
Mm.
Whereas now I realise I am enough.
So you're worthy of that love now?
I'm worthy of that love, and I'm accepting of that love.
Fantastic.
And it all starts with the self, and it's complemented by having someone so loving and nurturing and giving as Kirk in my life.
You
and I'm grateful for that.
You still surf?
I still surf every day.
Do you?
Except when I'm in Melbourne.
Well, we should be doing this at Winkie because it was sort of 3 foot and a little westerly today.
Oh, really?
So it's still cold.
Yeah,
though.
But the water's 14 degrees.
Yeah, it's cold.
I surfed in Alaska and it was 15
yeah,
degrees.
Yeah, it's still cold. So you still surf?
I still surf every
day.
For different reasons now.
Yeah.
And I've fallen more in love with surfing now than I've ever loved it in my whole life. You know, I'm 44 years old and I'm attaining more joy as I get older because I'm just allowing it to happen. I'm not this relentless control freak.
Competitive beast
that just has to make it happen. And the mistake that I made when I retired is I went back into that survival mode mentality, and now I realise, you know, you can actually allow things to just flow and it can be effortless. It doesn't have to be pain and suffering and struggle all the time because we trust in it for too long.
Lainey, we normally finish the Howie games.
Yeah.
One of my two
with
kids.
A game?
No, well, it's like a game.
Okay.
One of my two kids, I've got two, as everyone knows that listens to this show, a four-year-old by the name of Mac, who woke up one day and declared his new name is the Big Penguin. And that's the
why?
Way he rolls. No one knows. He still doesn't know, but he will not answer unless you call him, and not just Penguin, it has to be Big Penguin.
Bing Penguin, like the Emperor Penguin.
Yeah, I don't know. He's a lunatic. And,
well, he's your son.
Yes, correct. And the Pickle, my six-year-old, is my daughter.
She calls herself the Pickle?
Well, that's a name I bestowed on her. We still don't really know why, but so I've got the Pickle
has
and the Penguin at
home. She accepted that?
Yeah, she loves it. She's embraced it. She often features in the podcast, actually. In fact, she seems more popular than me, but that's a whole other point. I always have a chat with him in the morning or the night, last night over dinner. Who are you talking to today, Dad? Oh, Elaine, she's a surfer, and the kids are learning to surf. And
nice.
Whoever is more engaged with the story that I tell them about the person, they put a question to the guest.
Okay.
So we have a question for you from the Pickle.
Oh.
Hi, Lane. Pickle here. I'm just a shore break operator on my softies and I'm a bit scared to go out the back, so what should I do?
And she's six?
She's six.
I don't think I knew the word operator for the six-year-old.
Oh, she's a well-read young lady.
Yeah,
so basically,
obviously. She's going to be a journalist.
Yeah, she's operating in the shore in a softie, and every time she looks over her shoulder, she has fear about the wave that's coming, Lane, and she wants to know what to do to overcome it.
Right.
Pickle.
Pickle. Thank you, Pickle. Thank you for throwing me under the bus.
You're lucky it wasn't a penguin because he popped up with something like, did Lane ever go on a boogie board because I don't think they're cool? And I said, I don't think we can go with
that
penguin.
I did go on a boogie board, but only when the waves were really, really small. We used to play boogie board derby. And so all of us would catch a wave together and see how many times we could run over each other and stay on our board. The answer to that question, Pickle, is the only way you can overcome a fear is to first acknowledge that you are afraid. And then you have to have the willingness to confront it. And so the only way that you can do that is actually paddling out a little bit further. You have to just get past the shore break. The thing with fear is that people think that the only way they can confront it is to go all the way out the back. And that will create more fear.
Right.
It's like having someone having a fear of heights and then going bungee jumping. It's not going to change your fear of heights. You've got to take two steps forward, then take one step back. And so if she's only surfing the shorey, she just needs to go outside the shorey just a little bit and catch another wave that's just a little bit bigger than the shorey and then ride that in. She'll realise, oh, okay, that's not that bad.
You listening to this, Pickle?
Yeah, come on, listen up, Pickle. And then after she's had a couple of waves just outside the shore break, she'll get a little bit more comfortable and go, okay, I can do that. Now just go out a little bit further and a little bit further. Because I think about how I was able to build up my ability just going from surfing at Manly and 1 foot waves to 50 foot waves in Hawaii. It wasn't an immediate transition where I went from surfing shore breaks to 50-foot waves.
Yeah.
It was a gradual process. And all of us in our lives, we follow processes to improve our capacity and our abilities and our knowledge and our learning. So if you're surfing 1 foot waves tomorrow, paddle out when it's 1.5. The next day, paddle out when it's 2 foot. So I started in 1 foot waves, then I surfed waves that were 3 foot, then I would paddle out. And so in days when it was ceiling height and I was really scared, I would paddle out with someone and I'd let them know, I'm scared. And they went, well, just go and sit on the corner and watch it. It was when I went and surfed ours. I went in there going, that wave is ridiculous. I want nothing to do with that.
I can understand.
Because I'm scared.
Yeah.
So I went, well, I'm here now. And it's all about your attitude, and your attitude starts with how you think. So if you're willing to overcome it, you will take actions to do so. If you're not willing to overcome it, then you will allow your fear to enable you to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. I can't overcome it, so I won't. And we'd rather be right than happy, right?
As you told us,
as Pickle. As I told you. So Pickle, paddle out just past the shore break tomorrow. Just on the other side of it, in between the big the bigger sets at the back and the shore break in the middle, get someone to push you into a wave and keep your eyes up. Surfing is a great analogy for life. Where you look is where you go. And most surfers, they don't want to go into the pit, but they'll keep looking at it. Yeah. And Jules Allen taught me this. If you look at the pit, you eat shit.
Now, Pickle, I'm sorry about lunch
language
Pickle. There.
Yep.
Now, Pickle, if you are listening to this, once you get to 10 foot, Dad's no longer coming with you. And then you're out in your
I'll
lane.
Be out there with you, though.
Lane.
I'll take you.
So much having a chat with us on the Howie Games. You covered some very personal topics in a beautiful way.
Thank you.
You're an AO these days, which is
That's
a friggin'
true.
Thing. Lane Beachley AO, thanks for having a chat with us on the Howie Games. May you catch many more waves.
Thanks for inspiring us too, Howie. Thanks for sharing.
Cool.
Cheers, thanks for having me.
Ta. Thank you so much to Lane Beachley, a woman in high demand for very, very good reason. Thanks as always to Michael James, continues to whack away getting the Howie Games to air. Thank you to you all out there for listening once again. As always, we'll be back with another episode next Thursday. Until then, peace and love.
And we can do it if we try, try, try. If we try, try, try. If we try, try, try.